Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Today we have Russ Heddleston, founder of DocSend. I'm sure you've had that moment where you've sent out an attachment and wondered if anyone is actually reading it well. Russ and his colleagues have tried to solve this problem by creating links which you send instead of attachments that will allow you to track user behavior. So imagine you send out that important pitch to investors or that important pitch to a new client. You now know how much time they've spent on page one, page two, page three, etc., and you know how they've interacted with it overall. You'll hear Russ tell more about it, but it's a very powerful tool. And I think it really has the power to change and as he'll tell you, make an honest reader out of your reader as well. Russ has been riding shotgun in the second wave of the tech boom since he graduated from Stanford in 2006 with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in computer science. He worked at Trulia and Graystripe, where he was the director of engineering prior to going to Harvard Business School. While he was at Harvard, he launched Pursuit, which was absorbed into Facebook, and then he left Facebook to start DocSend. It's a lot of life packed into a decade on the job. It was a lot of fun talking to Russ, really articulate guest. Here's my chat with Russ Heddleston.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Hey, so Russ, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I mentioned to you before we started recording, but for our listeners, this is Russ is our guinea pig here on the phone podcast, and from the sounds of my headphones, so far so good. So thanks for joining us all the way from out west in Silicon Valley. So Russ, I feel like you're kind of the, I don't know, maybe I'm going to make you blush by saying it's kind of like the prototype here of the modern entrepreneur. You know, you studied computer science at Stanford, earned a BA and a master's degree. You did some robotics research there and you graduated into a fairly robust like tech ecosystem. I'm imagining you were just knocking away, recruiters and offers. Tell me if I'm wrong. And how did you make your choices as you graduated, presuming there were many offers for you?
I did. I was fortunate enough to get some offers. But before going to Stanford, I'm from South Dakota mostly. So, entrepreneurship and technology were not things that were kind of predetermined for me. It's just something I kind of fell into as an interest when I got to Stanford, because it's just kind of in the water there. Everyone's really excited about it. And, someone made the analogy to me when I was an undergrad that, if railroads and in the 1900s were, technology today. So it's like I want to be involved in the interesting things of our time, and that's computer science. So that's how I got into it initially. When I graduated, I did have some other offers, and the thing that was interesting about entrepreneurship was just that it's unknown and interesting things will happen. And so I was actually deciding between a big tech company, going and being a management consultant at McKinsey, or joining this small six-person startup. And I happened to know the lead investor for that company, Graystripe. And I just really liked the team. I liked the opportunity. It made sense to me. And I was just really interested to see where it would go and what would happen. So that's how I ended up picking that one as the first job I had out of my master's program at Stanford.
Wow. So I called you a prototype before, and now I call you like a poster child for VFA, because, that's kind of what VFA is all about, trying to get people to spurn the easier path where the recruiters lurk, like from from banks and consulting firms and to join six-person startups like Graystripe. So you joined as the director of engineering, and or did you join as was that your title when you joined?
No. As a 22-year-old, joining, I joined as like their generalist on the business side, but as a software engineer. So I ended up kind of chipping in, but I just wanted to help out on the business side there. And then we had this snafu where the company grew really quickly, and then the VP of engineering left and took about half the company with him. So it's like one of those battlefield promotions where it's like, our engineering team is in trouble. And I was like, great, I'll help.
So you quickly promoted. Gotcha. Okay. Were you daunted by that? That was my point. That you're, early 20s, and you're, in this position with this startup. And did you feel ready for it?
It's all about the context for it, I guess. I think I would have been daunted if someone had, kind of positioned it to me as like, this is really important. Like, there's a lot of pressure on you. But at the time, I was just the best person for the role. So we had a really strong and awesome CTO, Andy Choi. So just getting to work with him was really fun for me. And we're really complementary in our skill sets. And so what I worked on versus what he worked on. So it was really more about a partnership and then building the team back. And I'd already been there for a little while, so I had some good context for what was going on. So the set of things that needed to be done was pretty clear. And the title that got put on top of it, Director of Engineering, was really not as important.
Right. And so you ultimately went and got your pre-MBA. You ultimately went and got your MBA, but your pre-MBA at this point, and some of managing is obviously innate. You don't need to take courses to do it. But, how did you find yourself managing members of your team? Like, who was the pre-MBA Russ Heddleston?
It was about the same as the post-MBA Russ Heddleston. I will say, actually, that I studied engineering primarily because I was told to go learn a real skill, and I actually always wanted to study business because I think business is fascinating, I think people are fascinating, but the advice I got was good advice, which was go learn a specific skill and then learn the business of that later on. And so I learned the business of software after learning, the fundamentals of how to build software. Managing the team at Graystripe, my first manager experience, there were a lot of takeaways I had from that. Managing is really hard. I remember I had to put an employee on a performance improvement plan and then ultimately let them go, and that was a really hard experience. Not sure I dealt with it all that well. I later learned in business school that no one really deals with it all that well.
Right.
It was more like lowering my expectations about how to do that. Like, one third of all firings end with the person not being fired. I thought that was an interesting stat that I learned in business school. Like, it's just hard to do when you get into that meeting. So in retrospect, I did an okay job with that. And then the people we brought on, just finding the right people for the right roles and making them happy. My takeaway from that was it's primarily about making people feel fulfilled and like they're doing a good job, and then they will do a good job. But it was more just a bit of trial by fire in that particular position.
I think one third of all, so I'm an entrepreneur also, and I think one third of all, I fired very, very few people, but I think one third of them have ended up with me weeping and them consoling me. It's okay. You're going to be okay.
That's about right.
Yeah,
stressful for everybody.
It is. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's something you can never get used to. I mean, I don't. Maybe some people do, but I certainly haven't. So you join Graystripe, and it's this like juggernaut, and it's raising money and grows to like $30 million in revenue pretty quickly. And then you go to Harvard Business School. Like, what was the thought process in leaving Graystripe? And, was that a really tough decision?
It was a tough decision. I had always wanted to go back to business school. And, the company had just kind of reached a point where I thought it was best that I find a replacement for me, to someone who had more experience in the role. And so it was just something I wanted to go do. That was just a good time for it. So I had a very good run. I was at Graystripe for 3 years. I remember in my interview for business school, they asked me like the kind of the same question, like, why do you want to go back to business school? And my answer was that I just feel like it's going to be a really interesting couple of years for me. I really want to learn about this stuff. Like, oh, okay, that seems like a pretty good reason. And so that's pretty honest. It really did like the content of the degree. And I found a really good replacement for me at Graystripe as well, who did an amazing job growing and leading the team for the next few years. He's actually the VP of engineering at Pandora now. So he's gone on to have like a really good career. So it all worked out well for everyone on all sides.
So no looking back. It was the right choice.
Yeah, it was the right choice. I was there for a while. They ended up selling the company later. The industry was consolidating. Growth was slowing down a bit. So I wanted to go get some different experiences having been there for a few years. So it worked out just fine.
So you went to HBS, and I'm curious, like, I know you just said a second ago, you kind of said, oh, you know, this is just going to be a good experience. I'm going to learn a lot. But did you go in intent on starting a company? Like, what was your plan entering business school?
Yeah, I wanted to try starting a company. And my plan was to start a company while I was in business school. And my thought process was, well, if the company is successful, then I'll drop out and I'll have a successful company. That's great. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll stay in business school and I'll have an MBA, and that's fine too. It just seemed like being a student's a really good cover, and it gives you the space to work on some interesting things. It's really hard to think of a business to work on while you have a full-time job. Most jobs are, you know, more consuming than you have hours in the day, so just making room to work on something on the side just isn't really feasible. So when I went out to HBS, I had a couple of friends I had worked with before that I'd already chatted with about working together again. And so while I was in business school, we started a company and worked on that for a little over a year. That company is called Pursuit.com.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, and I agree. It's tough to start a business when you have a business, because business can be all consuming. But so can like school and the socializing that comes with school. Like, what were you cutting back on to start Pursuit?
Yeah, I mean, the saying in business school is like you can sleep, partying, and school. You can only pick two of the three. So if you throw in startup as a fourth, I think you can still only pick two of the three. So sleep wasn't one of them for sure. It was mostly school and the startup. Those are the things that I did. I didn't get the Baker Scholar Award or anything for, you know, excellence in the classroom. There's definitely more I could have done preparing or doing homework or just, you know, like spending more time with, you know, on things at school. But I was, you know, just writing code, traveling out to San Francisco, kind of building our business, and then sitting in the classroom hearing interesting lectures from professors on topics that I wanted to learn about. And I did actually make a lot of really good friends in business school as well, but I definitely wasn't leading the charge in terms of socializing or partying.
Right. So you started Pursuit, which was described as a bridging, maybe you can better explain it to me, but bridging social and professional networks as a social referral site. Is that an accurate, why don't you explain it instead of me explaining it?
Sure. Well, so I had just come off this experience at Graystripe where I had to recruit an engineering team. And that's really, really, really hard. And the people mostly came from our own networks. But referral programs are messy and hard to do and hard to track. So the thought was, why don't we help companies recruit by having a software-enabled referral system for them to use? Referral systems continue to be a really great source of candidates for companies. And what we built is a feature that could be used in a lot of other systems and is actually used in companies like Greenhouse and Lever and modern day applicant tracking systems. But that was the theory. And so, you know, me and my two co-founders built a prototype. We signed up maybe like 50 companies to use the thing, did a bunch of interviews, and it was a very solid value proposition. So that's what we ended up building out.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
And so Pursuit was kind of was absorbed by Facebook. How did you and your co-founders like determine that that was a reasonable choice? And obviously Facebook being like a pretty daunting player in any sort of referral space or any sort of any social space. How did you determine like that you had taken it to its logical end?
Yeah, that's really hard. I actually wrote one of my papers in business school, which I'm happy to send you as a kind of like a post-mortem, like while I was going through it, kind of a cathartic experience. Because to start a company, you have to be fanatically excited about it. Like, this is something that has to exist in the world. Like, we have to build this. It's going to be amazing. And so we went through the fundraising process. We went through the sales process. We built the whole thing out. To reach a point where you kind of recognize the facts for what they are and decide like maybe this isn't quite what we thought it would be. In our case, the order in which things happened was fundraising was fine. We could raise money for this thing. Sales was fine. We could sell this thing. But then when we actually got companies to use this referral system and we were looking at the data did not match up with our expectations. A lot of people got referred to companies out of network. The referral bonuses that got paid out, people felt weird about money being involved in it. Mm. And when we looked at the numbers and when we did interviews with our customers and the users of it, we found a couple logical gaps in our thinking that changed the problem statement kind of significantly. And that's the whole exploration process that you need to go through, the trial and error. In the case of our product, what we learned meant that we had to change things pretty significantly. So the question was like, oh man, do we go back and do we start over again, or how are we going to change things? We decided at that point it was worth exploring just getting acquired. So we went and interviewed at LinkedIn and at Facebook. At Facebook, we had sold them on Pursuit, using the product for the company, and their response was, "You guys are awesome. Why don't you come just chat with us?" And so we chatted with LinkedIn as well, and decided to go with Facebook. It's what you call a talent acquisition, where they covered a bunch of our debt and kind of like paid back money and stuff, and then made us a really good deal on working there. And the theory on their side was that we were going to help them compete with LinkedIn and build out a more professional side to Facebook. They ended up not doing that, but I did end up being the product manager for Pages, which is kind of the entity that companies use on the Facebook platform. And that was really interesting. We also used our learnings to redo the internal recruiting system at Facebook and their own referral system. So we got a lot of value out of that as well. Deciding to shut down Pursuit was a difficult choice, but in hindsight, it was the right decision. I don't think if we had pushed harder on the way we were building it out, it would have worked out in the end.
It's interesting. The entire life cycle of Pursuit happens while you're in school. Like it's almost an accelerated I'm imagining a mashup or a bunch of quick cuts on in a movie that like accelerates time. Like you went through that whole thing. And,
this is like the Rocky montage scene or something.
Exactly. I was going to reference a Seinfeld scene in which Jerry goes through an entire relationship in about in less than one episode, and they show the videos. But I think even Seinfeld is dating me out of our audience at this point. it's pretty amazing that you had that whole experience while in business school. All those learnings, have to have been really helpful. I mean, when you were, you moved to Facebook as a product manager, seeing obviously growth on like a really massive scale. I mean, what were the key learnings from your time at Facebook?
Oh, I mean, it's so different. I interned at Microsoft as well when I was an undergrad. I also interned at Dropbox really early on. Every company is so different. So the takeaways for software at scale are, I think, always different. Some things are constant, like just keeping in mind if you're at Facebook scale, like one of the features we were adding to Pages was adding friend connections, like which of your friends are connected to this business in some way, shape, or form. And so that friend, like having that social connection, you know, we were thinking would make you more connected to that company. Like, oh, 10 of my friends like Best Buy. That's cool. I guess I like Best Buy too. Just computing and storing that information, we had to spin up a bunch of new just server centers, and it was just millions and millions of dollars a year just to implement that feature, just in the back end storage that was required for it. So
that's crazy.
The types of considerations you had to make when thinking about things were different. Also, just at Facebook scale, like Facebook Pages is still the largest business software system in the world. There are more businesses on Facebook than anything else, just kind of as a virtue that there are more people on Facebook than anything else. So, you know, we redesigned Pages. We did the timeline design. Just thinking through the considerations of that and the ripple effect through businesses is just pretty astounding. I will say, to Facebook's credit, that they do a really good job of allowing the people who are building the products to make the right decisions, despite the consequences. So my takeaways from Facebook are mostly that they're doing things right, and it's a really impressive company, especially because they're able to break things, or at least change things at their scale.
So I guess the same question I asked you about Graystripe when you left for HBS, like, why leave Facebook? It's a sure thing, right? Like, you know, that's a company that's going crazy. The share prices continue to increase, and you walked away again. What were the considerations?
So it's kind of similar to working on Pursuit. There were two of my good friends from undergraduate at Stanford that I had hired on at Graystripe. We had said that we wanted to start a company together. Like, we'd like to do this. We'd like to start a company together. It didn't work out while I was in business school. They stayed on at Graystripe and were engineering managers there. But while I was at Facebook, you know, they were deciding they wanted to leave the company that had bought Graystripe, and they wanted to start a company. So it was more like a kind of, when would it align? If not now, when would we actually work together again? So I decided to leave to go work with them on DocSend. It just seemed like a, you know, I'd like to go try again. Facebook is a great company, lots of things going for it, no problems with it, but just, you know, life is short. If you're going to do it, you might as well go try. And I wanted to work with Dave and Tony again, so decided to just take the leap.
So are there any, when you're starting a business with friends like that, people who've been friends for a long time, you know, are there, I admit I've made the mistake. I tried to start a business with a friend, and I wasn't really evaluating that person on a business level. I was evaluating that person strictly on a friend level. How did you evaluate co-founders, and how did you ensure that you guys could work together and maintain friendships?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I look at my friends, like, the number of them who would also be good coworkers is small. So there's some Venn diagram of people you're friends with, people you can work well with, and then there, the overlap is some subset. So there's not that many people fall into both camps. In our case, we had already worked together at Graystripe, so we had de-risked it a bit in that sense. And we all studied computer science together, so we had all kind of done classwork together. So I both had a sense for how talented they were as engineers, and I also had a sense for how well we got along socially. And both are important. I don't think you need to be friends with your co-founders. You just need to work well together. But if you're also friends, that goes a long way creating a nice culture for your company. A bunch of our early hires at DocSend were also people we had worked with at Graystripe or elsewhere. And it's just a really good sign. If people have worked together before and choose to work together again, it bodes really well for the company. And so that's actually really helped us in recruiting. It also has helped us in finding investors. One of our investors was saying that one third of their investments blow up because the co-founders have a disagreement of some sort, which is pretty crazy high number.
Right. That is really interesting, which leads me to another question about co-founders and those blow-ups. I don't know if you've had big inflection points where there have been disputes, but how do you guys work to resolve disputes if there are three of you there?
It's pretty consensus oriented. We split our equity equally amongst us. Sometimes with co-founders, like someone will be like more important or more in charge, and like the puck stops here. But the three of us have known each other for so long that it's really we make decisions together about things, and that has its ups and its downs. On the upside, it's just nice to be supported by two other people. It's very stressful to start a company and to go through the whole process. So to have two other people you can rely on and trust is really helpful. In terms of decision making, I guess it depends. We early on divided up the responsibilities so there wouldn't be too much design by a committee going on. So, you know, one co-founder is the CTO, one co-founder runs all the product stuff, and then I do the sales and the like kind of financing and kind of other company stuff. And so, you know, within those areas, people just kind of make decisions and move forward.
So when you started DocSend, I mean, was this a pain point that you experienced? I feel like almost all businesses start from pain points. Like what was the genesis of DocSend?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think it's really nice if you're starting a company and you can relate to the problem you're solving. You know, whenever I see a founder who has no idea what their target user thinks or feels, it's kind of it's a risk. It's definitely a risk. In our case, a few different things came together that made the idea behind DocSend really attractive. I interned at Dropbox when there were 15 people in the summer of 2010, and we came out with the sharing model, or the schmodel we called it, where you could send links to files. And that seemed like a really useful thing, because you don't want to send attachments. Attachments are awful. It's better to send a link. Like, okay, and that makes sense. I also believe that people will always use documents. I was told by some early Microsoft employees that even in the early 90s, Bill Gates was discussing when documents would die. Like, when would the document format go away in favor of some web-oriented thing? And we still have the documents. It's like, okay, people are still going to create documents. Attachments aren't a good idea. You should send a link to it. And if you're in a business setting, you really want a bunch of other features around tracking and security and other things, and no other company was building that at the time. Also, while I was at Facebook, we had an internal system called Pixel Cloud that would track designs that you sent people. So I did some design work there as well, and so I would send around links in Pixel Cloud, and just getting that feedback on who actually looked at my content was hugely important to me, just being able to do my job well. So we kind of combined all these things, and we're like, I think tracking and analytics and security around document sharing is a real thing, and now seems to be a good time to start that company.
So you and your co-founders start this business, and I found this quote from you. I'll read it, even though you know you said it, but our listeners don't. Which is, even once you've convinced yourself you're working on a problem worth solving, it's a long road to making that vision a reality. Being successful takes a lot more time, effort, and patience than is visible from the outside. We've been working on DocSend for over a year, and it's still just the beginning. 1 year in, what was visible to the outside world, and what did people think of DocSend was, but what was it to you? What was viable, and what did you need to work on?
Yeah, so one year in, I guess what we did when we started is we started with a bunch of interviews. So we didn't sit down and start writing code. We thought that was a bad idea. We wanted to do interviews. So we did a bunch of customer interviews, figured out the pain points, the workflows, and they're like, okay, we've got a theory of DocSend, great. So we built a first version, we gave it to some people, they said, we love it, this is great. And we're like, awesome, okay, we'd like to hire out a team and like move faster, so we're going to go do fundraising. But I anticipated that if we were going to do fundraising, this is like 6 months in, that the question people would ask is like, well, why isn't Google doing it? Why isn't Microsoft doing this? And so we had to answer that question. And so what I did is I went around to all of the companies that we thought should build out what DocSend does, and showed them what we had built and showed them our customers, and like, hey, this is obvious, that it's obvious that you should build this. Why aren't you building this, or are you building this? And all of them were like, yeah, that's a good idea. Of course, we have this on our idea list, but we're not going to build it now. And then we also got some acquisition offers. And when we asked them what we would work on, they were actually going to put us on other projects just because we're a good technical team. And so that told me more than anything that they really weren't going to build out DocSend. It just wasn't a priority for them. So using that data and the other data, we went off and raised our seed round of funding, $1.7 million. That was 6 months in. And then 6 months after that, so 1 year in, we launched our product at TechCrunch Disrupt in New York City. So in 1 year, and that was really the first anyone could see of the product. Before that, if you went to DocSend.com, it was just blank. You was an invite-only kind of testing system that we had. And the first version was very quick and dirty. And then based on the feedback, we built out a really nice, elegant version that was the thing we launched after 1 year. And so yeah, I think for that quote, that's why that was just the beginning. You know, we've been working on it for a year, and we finally had something to show to the outside world.
Can you give me a sense of what that first year was like personally for you? You know, was sleep still the thing you were cutting out personally?
I was actually getting more sleep that first year than I was at Facebook.
Okay.
Facebook, I ended up sleeping at the office because there's just so much pressure and so many things going on. When you're working on your own, you set your own schedule, especially in, the beginning of a company. No one's yelling at you. No one's telling you to do anything. It really has to be motivated from within.
Right.
So in our case, we did work hard. We worked long hours, but there were steady hours that we chose. And, we rotated apartments. So one day we'd go to Dave's place, one day we'd go to Tony's place, we'd go to my place. And, we'd all just sit around the table and we'd set our schedule and we kind of like set our goals. And you have to be very self-motivated, and there's no feedback. There's no positive feedback from the outside. No one's telling you, this is fantastic, you're already successful. You have to tell yourself that. You get a lot of no's from pretty much everybody, especially if you're doing something that people don't know they need. It takes a lot of discipline. And if you were to look at it from the outside, it's hard to tell the progress is being made even.
Right.
Especially with a software business, because you're just sitting around typing.
And you raised the $1.7 million. And have you guys subsequently raised any money?
We have raised subsequent money that we haven't announced yet. But we're also generating revenue.
Got it.
The combination of the two has worked out well for us. The $1.7 million, though, was really critical at the beginning just to move faster, to be able to hire ahead of our revenue and to focus on building a good product, not on optimizing a small amount of revenue.
How quaint that you're generating revenue.
How quaint.
How old-fashioned of you, to be trying to make money. That's crazy. I think you're like one of the first tech companies we've had on here we're raising money. We're trying to be a real business. Is there any additional pressure on now? I mean, the things have kind of changed in the last couple of months. Is there any additional pressure on you to be profitable?
No, we still have enough cash where profitability isn't the immediate concern. It's just all about how fast can you grow, how fast can you scale. So, can we hire out a team of 50 salespeople, or can we spend a ton of money on, SEM? So there are a lot of experiments that we're running. The product is growing really quickly. People really like it. We have a really big product roadmap. There are a bunch of things that we're working on in parallel. Profitability isn't an immediate concern, but yes, we always want to make more money. So, if we suddenly turn profitable, I'd be very happy about that.
Right, sort of refreshing. It's interesting to talk about the product roadmap and how you went to all these other companies as they were, talking to them about like, hey, does this make sense? And it's like kind of on their radar screen. I mean, how do you? There must be just an endless number of features that you want to add to your own, to DocSend. Like, how do you make those choices? Is it just super obvious, or is it just a constant internal debate as to where to take the product?
Yeah, that's another great question. I think it depends on the type of product that you have. So for some companies that are very vertically oriented, if you're selling to a very specific target user, then that user dictates your roadmap. And it's pretty obvious what you need to add in what order. If you have a really horizontal product, those are much more difficult mm-hmm. to decide on what features to build if you're trying to be everything to everybody. So in our case, it is a pretty horizontal product, but we've picked a vertical salespeople that we specifically build for. So we prioritize their input over other input, and so that's how we dictate our product roadmap. And the things that matter the most to them are the things that we will prioritize in the product.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
When you raised your round of funding, did you, like, you had a prototype that was working. Did you have the data to back up how people were interacting with your own presentation, and were you changing your presentation according to the feedback that you got from your own program, if that makes sense? I don't know. I think I just ended up in some loop somewhere. But
yeah, exactly. It is something of a self-referential product.
Right.
We could use we certainly did use our own product in our fundraising process. Yes, the data was really important. We actually published some research earlier this year on best practices in fundraising, because it's hard to tell as an individual entrepreneur when you're sending around your pitch deck, what should be in your pitch deck. The useful feedback is more immediate on which investors looking at, which investors care, who should I follow up with, making sure the thing is secure, you're turning it off later. So we used it in that way, which is a bit more anecdotal. For instance, we found that the team slide was by far the most popular slide, so we put that one all the way at the beginning. I also found that the second most popular slide was this slide that was anecdotes about what we are. It's a Google Analytics plus Dropbox. It's had five different words, A for B. And the fifth one, I think, said, we're like cat insurance plus Asana. And it had an asterisk next to it. And at the bottom, it said, just kidding. We don't even know what that product would be. But it was just kind of in there to make sure investors were actually reading things. And that was the second most popular page, so we put that one up at the beginning. So we did make those modifications based on the time that people were spending inside the deck.
Were investors saying to you, well, I'm intrigued by this DocSend thing, but wait a second, I think you've customized this presentation so that I will be intrigued, so maybe I'm not that intrigued by this after all.
We did have one investor who whenever I would ask for intros to people, or I'd get intros, we'd send them a link to the deck, and I wouldn't really say anything. Hey, we're looking to raise money. Here's what we're working on. Here's our deck with a link. And so they'd have to read the deck to see what we were working on. And one investor opened it up, just looked at the team page. And we have a good team, but then he didn't look at anything else. And so he responded to me like, hey, I love what you're working on, and I can't wait to hear more. I forwarded it to my colleagues.
Right.
But I knew from the data that he didn't actually know what we were doing. All he did was look at the team page and then decide based on that that he would like to learn more, which is fine. It's just funny that he phrased it as, I like what you're working on. And so he did, in fact, forward us to his colleague, and his colleague thought that was funny when I shared that with them.
Were they ultimately part of the investor group?
No, we ultimately did not let them. They were more of an A round investor anyway, and that was our seed round.
Gotcha. It would have been quite the story, the inspirational story for others. Don't worry, if no one's reading your presentation, just make sure it ends up in the right hands of somebody who is willing to look at it.
Well, actually, our lead investor from our seed round, Jeff Clavier, I went back later and looked at the data, and he didn't actually ever look at our deck. but his colleagues did, and then we pitched him in person, and then he actually turned around and started using our product immediately. It was just funny to me that he never actually looked through the link that I had sent him on DocSend.
Are people afraid do you have family members who wait a second, he will know if I've read this you know, like, are your friends like skeptical of you that you've got like all this? I mean, I recognize that your system works through links, but are people sort of suspicious of communications with you? Like, oh boy, I better read this because Russ sent it.
I guess that'd be more like the email tracking thing.
Right.
No, I mean, like, we're solving a very specific need that only really exists in business communications. it's not a tool that I'd use with my sisters or my family or my close friends. Like, it's just not how those relationships work.
Right.
You know, I'm not sending them documents anyway. So yeah, it's, when we look at our usage, it's really only used in business transactions.
I can imagine that working in my family quite well. You know, my brother
maybe your family, it's a good fit.
My brother sending me something saying like, I want to know you read this. I want to know you're not just saying like, okay, let's go on a family trip. Fine.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm curious, like, you know, you gave us a little bit of insight in terms of how people interact with presentations, but I mean, you know, like, what have you learned about human behavior? Like, how much time will we spend? What's a lot of time to spend on a I don't know, what's a long presentation? I'm asking 50 questions and tripping over myself. how long can a presentation be? Exactly. Yeah, take a breath. How long can a presentation be? Like, can someone receive a 20-page presentation these days? What's the optimal size? What's a lot of time for someone to spend on a presentation at this point?
Yeah, well, so we have all types of documents in our system. So, you know, if you're sending like a Dickens novel or something, you know, that's going to be a different read time than a pitch deck is different than a product proposal.
Okay, so let's go with pitch deck. Sure, pitch. So, what's the longest a pitch deck can possibly be, and what's a lot of time for someone to spend on a pitch deck?
A lot of time is anything over 4 minutes.
Okay.
So when we did this research, We looked at, you know, we had a bunch of companies opt in to this research, and then, you know, they, you know, allowed us to look at some of their stats. And so we found that the average successful deck was read for 3 minutes and 44 seconds.
Okay.
and so a lot of people are like, wow, that's not very long. People should spend more time on things. People are actually incredibly efficient at flipping through information and making a decision on if they want to learn more and dig deeper. Mm-hmm. And ironically, the longer someone spends in your presentation, the worse it is for you.
Hmm.
Because the decks that were the most successful, like our deck had an average read time of about 2 minutes. And this was confusing for us. So as we dug deeper, what we found was that the decks that were the most successful seemed obvious. Like, if I was to read your pitch deck and it looked obvious to me, like, well, obviously this is a thing that should exist in the world. Like, why hasn't someone done this before? Like, of course. Like, I'm kind of left without any objections.
Right.
Like, those are the ones that are the most successful. It's actually really hard to create one of those. It's hard to create a deck for a business that doesn't exist, and it's obvious that that business should exist.
Hmm.
The decks that had the most time spent in them were the ones where the readers weren't really sure what was going on, and they actually spent the most time on the product pages because it wasn't even clear what the product did. So that's a bad sign. If someone's spending, you know, 10 minutes in your deck, I guess it's nice that they're giving you the compliment of spending that much time trying to figuring out what you do, but it's probably not a good sign. You should probably make your messaging clearer.
So you've been around for 2 years. Has anything changed? Like, do you have enough? Can you look and say, yeah, in 2013, you know, people spent, you know, 4 minutes, and now they spend 3.5, and, you know, it looks like they're going to spend. Is there any predictability from the data?
It hasn't changed from what we've looked at. Obviously there are a lot of privacy concerns with everything in our system, so we don't, other than in this like fundraising research, that's really the only glimpse into, you know, kind of average read times that we have. But those spanned a 6-month period, and they were pretty constant. I haven't seen anything in the market lately that would lead me to believe that any of those numbers have changed. The biggest thing we've seen shift has been just social norms. So you're asking, like, you know, does your family behave differently if they know you're tracking them? If we take as a microcosm the relationship between entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, we've basically created a new social norm where VCs can expect to get DocSend links to pitches. And this changes behavior in a number of ways.
Nice.
The first is that they just accept getting these links. Like, this is how you're going to get these links. So that's how it is. And then second, because they know that the other person is going to see their viewing behavior, they won't, for instance, open it up at 2 a.m.
Mm.
and look through it. They're like, oh, well, that's kind of embarrassing that I'm still working. Okay, I'm going to look at it in the morning and, like, oh, I can't spend too little time in it because that's offensive, and this is an intro from someone else, so I need to spend enough time reading it that they know, like, it's a respectful read-through of their deck. And so it actually motivates good behavior, which has just been an interesting equilibrium to reach.
That's a very interesting offshoot of the intent. That's a really interesting insight. I'm curious if you like are, when you do you experience time differently now? Like if you're sitting through a TV show or a play or I don't listen to a speech, are you like, no, I know you've got to get this information in earlier, and I know you got to move through this faster. Like, does this translate into into other audio visual experiences?
Well, this is completely divorced from DocSend, but I do think in general that storytelling is difficult, and there are good ways to do it, and there are bad ways to do it. So being able to hold the attention of an audience is hard, and you have to really know your audience. So if we're just looking at pitch decks or documents, you'll see in the data if you lose someone. Because it's kind of interesting, you're seeing them, watching them going through your content. If you're in a face-to-face meeting, they can't really zone out and start doing email, or they might, but that's really rude. So you're not really sure when they mentally kind of switch off if you're being boring. But you can see that if they're looking through it on their own, and you'll see where they fall off. So if you're trying to tell a good story and you want them to consume all the content, you need to present it in the right order. So the same thing exists in movies and other mediums. Yeah, so it's definitely something that passes through my mind, but I think it kind of passes through all of our minds if we're watching a movie. It's got a really slow middle to it, and it's like, this is probably not the best way to get through this part.
Right. So we're at kind of the beginning for DocSend, right? You're just under 2 years old, or just under? Am I just over two years old?
We're about 2.5 years old.
Yeah, just over 2 years old. Sorry. What does the future hold for DocSend?
Well, a lot of things. I think every phase of a company is really different. Especially being a founder, your job kind of changes every few months. It's never the same, that's for sure. We're up to 14 people now. We've got a bunch of positions open that we're hiring for. So as the team grows, it's kind of going back to management challenges, keeping everyone happy, office space, logistics. Now we have a sales team. Finances become more difficult to manage. So just across all fronts, growing things, breaking processes, remaking them. But we're just on track to build a large, profitable business. And so that's what we keep building for. Everything takes longer than you think it does, though. So it is still the beginning. And looking forward, it's like, it is. There's a ton left to do.
Right. What keeps you up at night at this point?
A lot of things. It's hard to know, kind of the optimal ordering of things that you should build. How should you allocate resources? So, they're just the product bets that we have to make. Are important, and software is really hard and costly to change. So there are far-reaching implications to what we choose to build. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. But otherwise, it's just people. Like, a company is a set of great people that you've assembled. So keeping everyone happy, keeping everyone motivated, those are the day-to-day challenges that keep me awake.
And do you operate with any particular business philosophy, or is it just, day-to-day, let's go? Or is there some sort of guiding principle in the way, you're trying to grow and manage DocSend?
I would actually love to hear what other people's answers are to that question.
I'll start asking it. This was an improv question, so also.
I think everyone who's a founder or a manager is kind of looking around being like, what's everyone else doing? What are the other best practices? We don't have a particular philosophy. Some people will spell it out, and they'll have like some acronym that's on the wall that stands for, like honesty, integrity, hard work, and empathy or something. So far, we haven't had to codify it, being a team of 14 people, but we will have to. I haven't learned at any other company that having a philosophy like that that's up on a wall is needed or helps a lot. But my sense is that to have our culture scale as we ourselves continue to grow faster, we will have to codify it. We will have to put it up. But at the moment, it's really just been hire good people, kind of tackle problems day to day. And that's been working well for us so far.
Awesome. I want to thank you for your time. We're bumping up against time, this was really interesting, and I appreciate you you joining us and being our phone guinea pig, and maybe we'll be able to check in with DocSend in the future. Thanks so much, Russ.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me on.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.